This meeting of the Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. We are at the end of this meeting. We are not going to adjourn. We're going to simply recess till 4 o'clock because we have some of the bills we were hoping to get done last week. Last Thursday, we're going to take up at 4 o'clock. I'm not sure if in this room or another room across the hall, I believe. But this noon, we have two bills. What I'm going to ask is if the authors be willing to present them together. They're different bills, and I think most of the witnesses on both sides are speaking to both of them. I know there's at least one who's speaking solely to the second of the two bills. But I wonder if Senator Kiffmeyer and Senator Anderson, if you want to come forward, and I don't... Here we have Senator Kiffmeyer is listed first, but and you are welcome to stay around for all of the testimony if you want. If you don't wish to, you're welcome to do that as well. But Senator Kiffmeyer, yours is on the agenda first, Senate File 306. Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Chairman Mitre and members of the committee. My pleasure to be with you today. And yes, it is my first time. I don't know if maybe you had a cookie resolution, but if it did, I didn't get the memo. My apologies, but glad to be here with you. And I know you're experts in this particular area, so I appreciate the opportunity to present to your committee. This is a very important subject. I come from a district whose neighbor is the Monticello Nuclear Power Plant. We live with it on a daily basis. I have toured the nuclear power plant and have stood 30 feet above the actual reactor without the counter hardly beeping at all. And we live in our community with people who work at the plant, who care very much about its safety and its operations. And so it's a normal part of our life. There are concerns, though, that, as you know, in any kind of equipment, there are times in the future where the entity itself may need to... They do an ongoing upgrading. They do a lot of work with it, and I have a testifiers here today that will address that specifically, as well as another testifier. But we live with it. We live next door to it. We experience it as safe, and we greatly appreciate the solid base electricity that it provides not only to our area but throughout Minnesota and the country. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that's my opening remarks, and I don't know if maybe Senator Anderson would like to make remarks prior to testifiers.
Sure. I wanted to have Senator Anderson as well. And just out of curiosity, your districts, which one actually is the plant in? Here, okay. Okay, I was not sure. Okay.
Senator Bruce Anderson actually has it within, but before redistricting, but we're very much neighbors.
You're both neighbors, and yeah, okay. And Senator Anderson, welcome to the committee as well for Senate File 536.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Senator Bruce Anderson, and I bring Senate File 536 to the committee and to the legislature. Having been in the service, been in the Navy for 4 years and served on an aircraft carrier, and having gone to school with many of my colleagues who served in the military, I roomed with a gentleman who was in the nuclear corps for almost 6 years, and he slept right next to the nuclear reactor while in the submarine, and he was very much, from talking to him and being schooled on the things that he was taught, very much confirmed that the reactor that he was sleeping next to was very safe. And I was just out to Norfolk, Virginia, a year and a half ago for the commissioning of the USS Minnesota, which is a nuclear-powered submarine, and was very impressed, having gone through the submarine itself and working with men and women of the armed forces, the Navy, seeing the expertise and the knowledge, and talking with chiefs and first class, second class petty officers who have been schooled in this and trained with it. I was very much impressed with what they have to say. But withstanding that, I just wanted to say that the language here is making it, the language in Senate File 536 is making a request to the Public Utilities Commission saying may issue a certificate of need for the construction of a single new nuclear-powered electric generating unit that is located at the site of a currently operating nuclear-powered electric generating plant in Minnesota. And, Mr. Chair, members, this means by which the means by which economical and reliable power can meet the scale the global economy requires. It is reasonable to support nuclear power because of these ideas and its ability for no carbon emissions, in fact, no emissions coming from these plants. The capacity of quickly providing adequate clean energy for the global demands is imperative. Today, one of our people who were supposed to come and testify was the city administrator from Monticello. He called just prior to the committee saying he wasn't going to be coming because of the weather. But he did say, in speaking with Monticello City Administrator Jeff O'Neill, he said, the XL nuclear plant has been an excellent utility to work with and has provided many jobs for local residents. Mr. O'Neill also stated that this utility has partnered with the city of Monticello to be involved with the community's myriad of activities. He also stated that it's because of the utility that Monticello City has flourished, been enriched, and been a big influence in attracting other businesses to the area. Mr. O'Neill also said, we know that the license for the nuclear plant has been extended to the 2030s, but I want to make sure that this utility is still going strong well after I'm gone, so that my children and grandchildren can experience the benefits XL Energy continues to provide to not only city residents, but also to the residents of the surrounding communities, the state of Minnesota, and the United States of America. Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd yield my rest of my testimony to those who would like to testify on behalf of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Anderson, and thanks for giving Mr. O'Neill for at least trying to shortly present his perspective, because I think he's the one witness we knew wanted to speak particularly to the one, because Senator Kiffmeyer's bill would deal with the entire moratorium and yours would just allow one exception for rebuilding. And just for clarity on my understanding, yours was to that they would put up a new a single new reactor at the site there. I'm not familiar if there's enough room on the site, but the assumption is that they would be putting up a second. They would have the ability to put another one on the site.
Mr. Chair, if granted.
Thank you. Are there any questions for either the two authors right now? If not, we thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to try and, because there are a lot of witnesses, we're going to try and we want to make sure that both sides have roughly equal time. And what I'm going to do is have the proponents go for half hour, then the opponents for a half hour, and XL Energy will have its time to make its comments after that. But so we're going to take people in the order they are. I know some people are from out of town and planning to be bigger. Their presenters aren't all going to be the same amount of time. But what I'd like to do is start now and have the proponents come up, beginning with Mr. Makala from the Heartland Institute. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nathan Makala, and I'm from the Heartland Institute in Chicago, Illinois. For nearly two decades, Heartland has studied economic and environmental impacts of nuclear power. Today, my testimony will explain why nuclear power is environmentally beneficial, why nuclear power is safe, and the economic benefits of lifting the prohibition of new nuclear facilities outweighs the cost. And I'm testifying on behalf of Dr. Jay Lear, our science director. He is not able to come because he's in Washington, D.C. So he is our nuclear expert. Nuclear power is America's largest source of clean air carbon-free electricity, which produces no air pollutants or greenhouse gas emissions. Beyond air quality, nuclear power can produce a vast amount of power from a tiny volume of fuel, and it requires far less land use than other so-called green energy sources such as wind. An average nuclear power plant occupies one-third of 1 square mile, whereas a wind farm would use up to 200 square miles of land to generate the same amount of power. In Minnesota, nuclear plants currently produce 21% of Minnesota's electricity and 56% of Minnesota's emission-free electricity, thus preventing the emissions of tens of thousands of air pollutants. Compact baseload nuclear plants are a direct substitute for baseload coal plants. As a result, opposing nuclear energy has been increased use of coal. It would be prudent for those who oppose nuclear energy to consider the consequences of this position. Legislation for action on climate change and against nuclear energy is an incompatible goal. Now that I've told you that nuclear energy is environmentally beneficial, I'd like to explain why nuclear power is safe. Nuclear power plants in the United States are held to the strictest standards in the world. Nuclear power plants are subject to rigorous Nuclear Regulatory Commission standards, oversight, including inspections, preventative and corrective maintenance, and extensive equipment testing. The NRC is also required to report to Congress the number of abnormal occurrences that take place at U.S. nuclear power plants. Beyond the NRC oversight, the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations keeps a database of operational issues in every nuclear power industry. According to this database, there has not been a single safety significant event since 2002 in the United States. Heartland Science Director Dr. Jay Lair, who is not able to be here, was quoted and believes that nuclear energy is the safest form of energy. Nuclear energy has ramped up its safety efforts in recent years. It has developed a diverse and flexible mitigation approach to address the risk of loss of power and maintaining effective cooling. More than 2 billion of safety enhancements have been implemented since 2011. Also, it should be noted that for half a century, there have not been any radiation-related health effects linked to nuclear power facilities. The National Cancer Institute asserts that nuclear power plants effectively protect the public's health and safety. Nuclear waste, and this is our main point too, is nuclear waste storage is no longer a safety concern. The NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, voted last Tuesday to lift a moratorium issuing plant licenses after finding that storing spent nuclear fuel on site at nuclear power plants is completely safe. This is science. The commission also voted to adopt a new rule reiterating that spent fuel rods can be stored at closed nuclear plants for long periods of time, and they can also be recycled. Minnesota nuclear plants will be regulated by the same federal agency nuclear plants around the nation are regulated by, meaning if you trust the federal government to regulate on issues regarding TSCA reform, Ozone NAAQS, the Clean Air Act, then you certainly must trust the federal government to regulate the nuclear power plants in Minnesota and to keep the state safe. I've discussed that nuclear energy is environmentally beneficial and safe, and now I'd like to talk about the economic benefits of nuclear power in Minnesota. Nuclear power is not an intermittent energy source, which makes it more reliable than renewable energy. Nuclear power produces electricity when needed, regardless of whether the sun is shining or the wind is blowing. Most plants have 18 to 24 months' supply of uranium fuel in their reactors. This allows for grid stability, which provides consumers stable and affordable electricity cost. Nuclear power employs more than 1,300 high school workers in Minnesota. Over $315 million in materials, services, and fuel for the nuclear plants are purchased annually from more than 1,150 Minnesota companies. The average payroll for a nuclear power plant, estimated at 550 workers, is $40 million and contributes $470 million to the local economy. Mr. Chair and members, I encourage you to separate facts from unproven fears that are often brought up when talking about nuclear power. Ultimately, government should enact only those regulations that are necessary to protect the environment and the public health. Nuclear benefits both the environment and the public health. In conclusion, an expansion of the nuclear power in the state would be beneficial to the environment. The industry has a proven track record of safety. New construction of the plants would provide significant economic benefits to your state. Therefore, Minnesota should lift its moratorium on the construction of new nuclear power plants. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this important issue.
Thank you, Mr. McCullough. And I will let members of the committee ask questions, but I will encourage us not to debate the issue or anything like that, but to hear all the speakers because we have a lot of people who want to be heard. But having said that, both for clarification or whatever, please feel free to ask questions. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, have we done any testing on the ability of the nuclear plant, I suppose specifically the Monticello plant, to handle something like a tornado or an earthquake in lieu of the Japanese disaster?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Senator Eaton. The subsequent testifiers will address that specifically,
okay,
if that would be okay.
Fine.
Any other questions for Mr. Mulligan? Thank you very much for coming. Ben Gerber from the chamber next. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce on energy regulatory issues. I'd like to thank the senators for both introducing these bills and start off in saying that the chamber has had a longstanding support of at least studying the opportunity for new nuclear energy in the state. As a ratepayer advocacy group, as well as lucky enough to count many of the utilities as members, we think it's important that all resources be on the table for possible inclusion into our regulatory mix, specifically with concerns regarding emissions and having 111D, as well as possibly other federal regulations coming down the line, the opportunity to at least study a carbon-free baseload resource like nuclear is really important. I think what's also important for the committee to note is that these are long-range planning. Utilities submit integrated resource plans right now that look 15 years out and study what the new and run many different scenarios about possible future energy mixes. And however, by having a statute that says you can't even build new nuclear, you're not going to include those in those runs. And that's what we think is problematic. If we want to really be honest about what is or is not the most the most efficient resource and specifically the most cost-effective, we need to look at those when we're looking at these long-range planning. Xcel just recently filed their integrated resource plan. I think Minnesota Power is coming up soon. So by putting this, by allowing utilities to at least study this option and put it in their mix, I think that's important. I also want to address, I know this will come up, is people always criticize the cost of new nuclear, and that's why we have a very rigorous regulatory system in our state to protect ratepayers, including my members. And so before a utility was even going to start construction, they would have to go through a lot of studies and get a lot of assurances through the Public Utilities Commission. And so I think, to say that we shouldn't even consider it because right now it's too expensive, I don't think really does our system and our regulatory methodology justice. Another important thing, and you'll hear this from some of the testifiers next, is these are good, high-paying jobs. If members of this committee haven't had a chance to go and visit either Prairie Island or Monticello, I highly suggest that you talk to some of the utility representatives and schedule that. I was amazed at having been on the facility, not only the security and how secure the facility is, but also the how professional people are at the facility, as well as a big issue that people bring up is storage. Actually getting to see where the storage is done, hopefully it made me even more feel even better about it, and I hope that you all get that experience as well. And I think the previous testifier mentioned on-site storage, where the Nuclear Regulatory Commission just did come out with a study, and I think having been able to see that on-site, and hopefully you will if you haven't already, get to see, should make you feel a lot at ease. But on behalf of the business community, we think this is a positive movement forward, specifically with some of the new federal regulations that are coming down, and it's important to at least have the opportunity to study putting new nuclear into our resource mix.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber. And I know a number of members of the committee have been out to one or the other of the plants, but I think if others on the committee are interested, let us know, because I think the utility has been willing to have people come. And it is important to see that. Yes, thank you, Mr. Gerber. Questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much. Harry Melander, Building Trades. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Senator Marty, committee members, my name is Harry Melander. I work as the chair of the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council, an organization that represents 60,000 plus workers in the construction industry. Thank you for all your help putting Minnesota's construction industry back on track. Today, my comments will be split between my role as at the state council and also as a resident of the state of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. My personal comments will be first. Three things happened to me on June 1st in 1973. I actually graduated from Johnson High School. My friends that were at war in Vietnam could come home and have a burger and a beer legally. And I was given an award by my high school environment teacher, Big John Neihard, an award that was in conservation, and I still have it on my wall today. In 79, while teaching in a community college in eastern Iowa, myself and some very energetic and energy conscientious students designed and built active and passive solar homes that were based off a model called the Mid-America Solar Energy Center, a program started by President Carter. My point is that energy and thoughtful conservation has always been an important part of my personal core values. Clean water, clean air, and an efficient means of powering our state has been what I and other Minnesotans care and support. A lot has changed since that time. My hair's gone. An Apple IIe processor couldn't hold a candle to a 10-year-old smartphone. Our state has confronted great challenges, and we discuss them. Depression, abuse, racial equity, gender balance. But yet we're still unable to have a discussion about what is a clean and efficient way to power our cities, industries, and agricultural needs. So after all these advances, we're still unable to have a discussion on nuclear energy. It's 2015. The Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council supports bills that allow people to discuss all options for conservation and energy efficiency. Nuclear needs to be part of that discussion. Thank you for your service, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Melander. Are there questions from members of the committee?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gil Haney from Electrical Workers. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bill Haney, Legislative and Political Director for the IBEW Minnesota State Council. We represent the workers that run both Prairie Island and Monticello nuclear plants, and I'm here today to testify in support of the Senate File 306. We support repeal of the moratorium because it's basically a meaningless law. There's no plans for utility to build large baseload plants at this time. If a utility needed baseload capacity down the road, they would have to look at all options, including nuclear. If they didn't, they would be subject to massive lawsuits from shareholders for not doing their due diligence to look at all sources that would benefit the shareholders. Nothing in the moratorium that prevents anybody from talking about a new nuke plant in Minnesota, from having the utilities investigate a new nuclear plant. If the spent fuel were dealt with on a permanent basis and the economics of nuclear power were to be adjusted so that they would be competitive in Minnesota, then, and the utility needed that kind of capacity, the moratorium would fly off the books, I think, in a blink of an eye. Repealing the moratorium, we feel, just makes sense. As I said, it's a meaningless law. If you do vote to repeal the moratorium, don't do it on the basis of jobs, because, like I said, nobody's got plans to build that size of a power plant in this state, and it won't result in any jobs, new jobs for my members, may for a few lawyers, but that's about it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Haney. Are there questions from the committee? If not, Ms. Henkel. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Annette Hinkle, and I'm with the Minnesota Utility Investors, and we are a grassroots organization of almost 27,000 members, and many of you probably know our members. We're the mom-pa retail shareholders of the seven investor-owned utilities that operate in Minnesota. On behalf of our members, I encourage you strongly to encourage you to support Senate File 306 that would remove one of the hurdles on the discussion on nuclear energy. We're encouraging you to consider all baseload options to be at the table when determining how to meet our future energy needs. You've heard a lot of that conversation about having this as an option and part of the discussion, and we just need to be on record to fully support that. From our members' perspective, very simply, they do want the discussion. They have a lot of interest and questions about the issue, and they want nuclear energy to be an option. Public Utility Commission was created to be part of the state agency with the technical expertise to oversee and make decisions on complex energy infrastructure projects. In addition, you've got the Public Utilities, Department of Commerce, Office of Energy Security, and the Attorney General's to protect ratepayers' concerns if we ever get down that path. But we do believe they should lift the moratorium and continue the discussion on nuclear energy. That, I haven't answered any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from members of the committee? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, we have Rick Evans that is a proponent that just happens to have been oddly down at the very bottom.
We understood XL was, they may be supportive of the thing. I didn't know what their position was. I didn't want to put them pro or anti or neutral. I figured we'd just let them be XL on their own.
All right.
So if they are proponents, that's fine. We were going to have him. I mean, I don't mind if he wishes to testify now. Mr. Evans, would you like to, or would you rather wait till your choice? You're coming up, so you can be next. And Senator Anderson, you're welcome to stay at the table. I know we need, for the next presenter needs the PowerPoints. So you can switch sides. Okay, Mr. Evans, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. I thought I got to break the tie. That was the way I wanted to honor him. I think out of fairness to both sides, I should probably come up now and be part of the proponents. We do support the bills for many of the reasons that have already been stated. We are moving as a nation into a much more carbon-constrained world. We're going to need all of the options on the table. I can't disagree with those who say it seems at this point to be very unlikely that a new nuclear plant is in our future, both from in terms of cost and the period of time it would take to build the plant and all of those other factors which would be part of our resource planning process under any circumstances. But at the bottom of the issue, we don't believe that it makes sense for an option to not be on the table, including all the options. I'm fond of saying that there's dozens of ways to make electricity, and every single one of them causes a problem for somebody. And that's certainly true with nuclear, but true with every other resource as well. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony. Be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. And I have one, Mr. Evans, just in terms of timeline. Your current plants are, the licensure ends in the early 30s, 31 and 33 or something, but
The Monticello plant license runs out in 2030.
Okay, and the other one is a couple years later for each of the reactors. How long does it take you if you tomorrow morning put one on the drawing board, when would you project that would open, just out of curiosity?
Well, Mr. Chair, I've got Terry Pickens is here with us. If you want to, he could answer technical questions at the end of the hearing or now or whatever you want to do. But
and the tornado question.
To the extent that there are questions about, you know, sort of those technical operations of the plant, I could give you an answer, but it wouldn't be true. So
it might be true. It might not be as refined as it is. Okay, well, let's see what the other questions are, and maybe we'll wait for that at the end, because I think it looks like we should have time at the end. Yet.
Thank you.
So please stay there, though. There are a few questions for you right now, though, I think.
I'll go technical.
Okay.
Same here.
Okay, technical ones, I guess. Okay. So no other question for right now. Okay, well, if you'll be around still. Thank you. We're going to have the opponents. I want to point out there was one. We got a letter in the packets from the Prairie Island Tribal Council. They could not be here, but they wish to express their opposition, I believe. I didn't read it that carefully. But that is in your packets for reading. And we'll start with Dr. Arjun Makajani, who's the president for Institute of Energy and Environmental Research in Washington. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for coming out here for snowy weather.
Yeah, I left Washington just as it was getting warmer, and I came here. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for asking me. I really appreciate being here. I was here a few years ago testifying before your joint committee on energy. Thank you.
Sorry about that.
testifying on this very topic, and Representative Hilty had asked me after the moratorium was upheld, so what do you think should be done? And so we did a Renewable Minnesota study. It's up on our website, ier.org. That was a technical feasibility study. Mr. Chairman, yesterday when we met, the reason I had my own computer up here, yesterday when we met, you asked me to say a few things about France that I hadn't been planning to, and as I indicated to you yesterday, I really love France so much that I married somebody from there. I love their trains. I love their healthcare system. But I think they have problems with their nuclear power plant. I said that last time I testified, or the time before. They haven't solved their waste problem. People say they recycle. They do separate their plutonium, which is 1% of their waste. They discharge 100 million liters of liquid radioactive waste into the English Channel. They have polluted the oceans all the way to the Arctic. 11 of the 15 members of the Oslo-Paris Accord, which is about the oceans, governments now, Western European governments, have asked Britain and France to stop polluting the oceans with discharges from their reprocessing plants, and they have not. Now, these are governments, not just Greenpeace, which I think has also done the same. They have, I think, about 10,000 bombs worth of surplus separated plutonium sitting around in France unused. They spend about 2 cents a kilowatt hour, by my calculation, extra to generate energy from plutonium, because it's much cheaper to generate energy from fresh uranium fuel. They use less than 1% of the uranium resource, even though they reprocess. And I have done two studies and presented them in French in France on their nuclear waste repository program. And I can tell you that when waste comes close to them, people don't like it. They are stuck. This is quite apart from, you know, we're not talking just about technical matters because, well, every plant generates about 30 bombs worth of plutonium every year. When you separate it, you have a situation that's quite complicated. Right now, there have been discussions in Washington today about proliferation. So that's enough about France. I will. So basically, the French haven't solved the waste problem. They haven't solved the cost problem. They're trying to reduce their reliance on nuclear energy. And maybe we ought to take a lesson from that ourselves. So there's a lot of talk of putting everything on the table. So I thought I would show you the result of putting everything on the table. That's a smorgasbord. Putting everything on the table is nice for a smorgasbord, but the electricity system is a very finely tuned system. All the electrons must be balanced all the time, every second. It doesn't work like a smorgasbord. I'm going to address why I think you should not put nuclear energy on the table. On the right, of course, you have a smart grid. We're moving to a smart grid. We need to move to a smart grid. New York has, for instance, reforming the energy vision process going on that arose out of Hurricane Sandy mainly. We need to go to a distributed energy system. Nuclear energy is the antithesis of a distributed energy system. I'll address that a little bit. Here are some cost realities. So these costs are basically derived from Wall Street Lazard, 2014. I can send you their original, but this is, I've added distribution costs to everything because you've got to bring nuclear energy to the customers. You have it on your rooftop, it's already there. So you can see nuclear energy is, even according to the moderate calculations of Wall Street, before you take the delays and the cost overruns and everything into account, among the most expensive resources, except solar rooftop is about the same, but doesn't have the same risk, cost overruns, delays, and waste problems. It's not every energy source does have its problems, but it's not the same scale of problems. Solar energy doesn't have problems that run into tens of thousands of years. It doesn't generate 30 bombs worth of plutonium every year to run a gigawatt plant, and so on. All right. So here are some of the problems you're inviting. very long lead times. I've been studying energy since 1970. And since 1973, almost every official electricity forecast that goes out 5-10 years has been wrong. Usually they are in the overestimate side. This is disastrous for nuclear plants. That's the reason in the 1980s, about 1970s, about 120 reactors, almost as many as were built, were canceled. I'm not saying this just from hindsight, because I'm one of the few people who can claim that in 1976, I was a co-author of a report commissioned by the Department of Energy working at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab, in which we said, these lead times are too long, these are too capital-intensive, you can't look out that far, and you may have a financial crisis coming. And we did have a financial crisis. Actually, I believe there was a bond default in the early 1980s that led to some very serious problems on Wall Street. So lead time is a huge issue. You can put solar on your rooftop in a couple of months. You can build a big, large-scale wind farm in a couple of years. Thank you. So this is a very, very central part of nuclear risk. Right now, we have 5 reactors being built. One is Watts Bar that was started in 1972 or 1973. It was restarted construction about 5 years ago. They said it would be $1.5 billion and a couple of years to build. It's been $4.5 billion and it's still not open. Vogtle 3 and 4, which are new reactors, they are delayed. There's no opening date now for Vogtle 3, so far as I know. VC Summer 2 reactors, also delayed, also with cost overruns. And for the reactors in the so-called nuclear renaissance that didn't get off the ground, there have been hundreds of millions or billions of dollars that have been spent on paperwork. Almost all those projects are halted or moribund. So one of the problems you have is that the nuclear industry, Wall Street, refuses to finance nuclear power. They don't want to take the risk. They have already been burned. I believe it was Forbes in the mid-80s that called nuclear power, this is a paraphrase, I'm sorry, I don't have the exact quote, nuclear power one of the greatest management disasters in business history. So Wall Street doesn't want anything to do with this stuff. That's why the hat in hand to government and to ratepayers in Georgia, South Carolina, and Florida, ratepayers are forced by law to pay the utilities to build nuclear power plants. They don't get a refund if it isn't finished. They don't get to own the plant if it does. It goes into the rate base. The stockholders profit. I'm not surprised that the investors want you to repeal the moratorium. But maybe the ratepayers might not. You might want to ask the ratepayers of Florida who are paying, who have been paying for years, and those projects are now stopped after hundreds of millions of dollars of expenses. I think the prospects that any of those 4 reactors will be finished are dim, but the ratepayers are still paying in every bill. And they don't get a refund. So here's a spent fuel pool. I'm going to talk about that and Fukushima a little bit. Here are casks. So the NRC decision to allow licensing to go on by saying that waste is safe to store on site, I'm very, very familiar with this. I submitted extensive comments on the generic environmental impact statement when it came out in October 2013. I was one of the experts for interveners in that case. I'd be happy to send you my testimony, my comments on that environmental impact statement for the record, because I think, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, you'd be interested, because I made specific reference, if I remember right, to Minnesota reactors. One of the reasons I mentioned that is if you have a severe accident, say in a spent fuel pool here in Monticello or Prairie Island, of the scale of Fukushima, or of the scale that was envisioned or hypothesized by Brookhaven National Lab in the 1997 studies, a very severe accident, the entire Mississippi River Basin would be compromised, or a very large part of it. I understand that this the Twin Cities do have their water intake So we're not talking about the routine operation of nuclear power plants, which have somewhat more problems than have been presented. I'd be happy to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it in my testimony. But the federal government has decided to let this go ahead, and nuclear waste storage on site is safe, not for 10 years, not for 100 years, not for 500 years, but forever. They have said that every year Congress will appropriate money for waste storage and security, even if these plants are shut down, and every 100 years that Congress will appropriate even more money to change out the whole infrastructure of waste handling on site, and that this can go on for tens of thousands of years, longer than recorded history, and longer than human beings, at least Homo sapiens, have reportedly walked on this earth. I believe not only me, but the recent chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has been very uneasy with this idea that government will be there not for a couple of hundred years, in which time this country has had a civil war, which we had to remind the NRC of, but forever. And for the NRC to have said that in the middle of a government shutdown, I think, was not only to ignore the facts, but in my opinion, was irresponsible. When a Nuclear Regulatory Commission doesn't pay attention to the fact, you'll have to ask yourself about the character of the regulation. The regulations themselves are fine, but the watchfulness may be lacking, my opinion. That's Fukushima. So it's fine until it's not fine. It's 24/7 until it's 0 over 365, which is what it is in Japan right now. 0 over 365. 0 over 365 in San Onofre, Kiwani, Crystal River. In this country, we have 5 examples in the last 3 years. Why should nuclear not be on the table, even though you've heard that it's unlikely that anyone is going to build a nuclear power plant just by putting nuclear on the table? What I think is very likely to happen, maybe not Xcel, but the nuclear industry, Nuclear Energy Institute, people like Warren Buffett's company did in Iowa, they will lobby you for construction work in progress, this thing that is worse than a tax. And your ratepayers, if you pass that, will be paying into funds where ratepayers will pay to build a nuclear power plant, because that is the only way nuclear power plants can be built. And so the people who are asking for this, not directly the people, not the legislators, but the nuclear industry, will come to you and ask for that. It sucks the air out of the energy policy discussion. We need to move away from, we've got too much centralized generation, more than 90%. We need to go to a distributed system. Nuclear power is the worst partner, literally, technically. Even the people in the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission have recognized it is the most inflexible of all sources. And the former chairman of FERC, John Wellinghoff, has said, talking about nuclear and coal power plants is like talking about mainframe and punch card machines in the age of iPhones, I believe iPhones were mentioned. We need to go to a much more supple and responsive system. And in the modeling of a renewable energy system by National Renewable Energy Lab, they said if you have 80% renewables, the rest of it has to be very supple, flexible, and responsive, all things that nuclear is not. We should look to eventual retirement of these power plants. There's going to be difficulties in every community where any industry is retired. This is a problem by the way we run the economy. I totally understand this. We need to address it, but it's not a reason to build new nuclear power plants. As I've already said, nuclear is the worst complement to solar and wind. There are lots of alternatives. We can see a renewable energy future. Here's part of our modeling. This is very theoretical modeling, but it shows you that you can deal with variable renewable sources quite in a straightforward way. My conclusions are that not all options should be on the table. For instance, we can build all of our electricity requirements from solar thermal generation, which is air-cooled, in about 150 miles square on the side in Nevada. I would advocate that you should not put this on the table. even if it's just 10 cents a kilowatt hour, even though it is completely renewable and completely carbon-free, because it's too vulnerable from a security point of view. You don't want to put all your generation in one place. People have said we should put solar energy in space where you can get the sunshine 24/7 and beam it back to Earth. I don't think that's a very good idea. So there's an initial screening. We can talk about all kinds of energy sources. There's been plenty of talk about nuclear, but putting it on the table so you make it part of serious planning, I think we know enough that that should not be done. At least you should say, let the federal government get its waste house in order and not promise that the government is going to be there for 10,000 years when there's absolutely zero evidence that any institution can survive for 10,000 years. And so until the federal government gets its waste house in order, and today we are farther away than we were in 1982 when the Nuclear Waste Policy Act was passed, I think you should stick with your nuclear moratorium. Minnesota is one of the five leaders in the country in terms of energy policy. You've done amazing things. We in Maryland and many other states look to your continued leadership. You're moving to a smart grid. You are studying it in the university here. You've got some of the electrical engineering leaders in the country. I've met one of them. We need to continue in that direction. You don't want to suck the air out of that energy policy room in which you have brought this state so far. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Marcozzani. Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, you started your testimony talking about France, and you indicated that France discharges radioactive waste into the English Channel.
Yes.
Okay. From our three nuclear reactors, how much nuclear waste do we discharge out of those into the Mississippi River?
Well, actually, I haven't looked. We did compile discharges from the nuclear power plants, every nuclear power plant, into the air and into waterways. But I don't have internet access, otherwise I could give you the number right away. Every nuclear power plant routinely discharges radioactivity into the air and water, contrary to what you've just heard. Tritium is the main pollutant. Tritium is radioactive hydrogen. It is discharged as radioactive water. It is well below the drinking water limits. I don't know of any case where it exceeds the drinking water limits, but every nuclear power plant by design will discharge nuclear waste, some nuclear discharges, into both waterways and the air. So I can supply you with the numbers, no problem.
So, Mr. Chair, so what you're saying is the discharge is infinitesimally small?
No, I'm not saying that.
It's very difficult to identify.
No, that's not true. I didn't say that. I said they are below the drinking water standard. The drinking water standard is 20,000 picocuries per liter. Drinking water standards are set normally for something called reference man, a 20 to 30-year-old Caucasian male with West European or North American cultural and dietary habits. That's pretty close to an exact quote. We have advocated, and the state of California has guidelines for tritium that are about 50 times stricter than the drinking water standard. That is because tritiated water actually crosses the placenta, and we don't regulate actually for the most vulnerable. We have a report that I'd be happy to send you called Science for the Vulnerable.
Doctor, I hate to cut you off, and Mr. Chair, we want to keep moving. You can't give exceptionally long answers. Probably only have 10 minutes left for the antis. I just wanted to get on the record. You just said that the discharge that is being let go by our reactors is lower than the drinking water standards. In other words, the water we're discharging is cleaner than the water that normally exists.
No, you're conflating a number of things, Senator. The water that normally exists is natural tritium. Surface water normally have about 20, 30 picocuries per liter of natural tritium. There's some tritium from bomb tests also. Sorry, you asked a very technical question, so long answers. The discharges from nuclear power plants can run into 100, 200, 300 picocuries per liter, so many times the natural background. Every nuclear power plant, and I don't know the numbers for Monticello and Perry Island, but every nuclear power plant also emits tritiated water into the air. And nuclear industry data indicate that you have radioactive rain around nuclear power plants. We have asked the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to allow people who have private wells to monitor their wells, but the Nuclear to give the funds to do that, but the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has refused.
Senator Benson and Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to our testifier, I'm going to butcher your last name, so I'll call you Doctor. Doctor, you said we produce enough waste for 30 bombs. The process of going from waste to bombs isn't very straightforward.
You're absolutely right, Senator.
And Mr. Chair, I don't want the committee to be left with the impression that somebody can just go get a cask and make a bomb. It is not trivial, and to be left with that impression, I think, misleads this committee.
No, I'm sorry if I left that impression. I started with France, where they do separate the plutonium, so you do have to go through that process of separating the plutonium. The French do have 10,000 bombs worth of separated plutonium, that surplus that's sitting around. No, absolutely, you're quite right that it is a complicated process that would take a lot, but there are advocates in this country that we should do that, be like France.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Doctor, you mentioned quite a bit about the smart grid. I was just looking at the Department of Energy website about smart grid. It mentions several of the stakeholders, and one of them is providing power quality for 21st century needs and accommodating all generation and storage options. And I was just listening to your testimony, and you talked about a supple and responsive system. What would that portfolio look like? And would that include hydro?
Yes. The world we're going into is where consumers are producers, and consumers also can store energy. You have the centralized and decentralized married in a very different configuration. So on the generation side, the large-scale generation side, hydro is actually the most supple and responsive, much more responsive even than gas. You've just got a valve that changes position automatically to increase or decrease the flow of water. It's actually the best complement on the generation side for wind. On the distribution and storage side, you know, gas is a very responsive source. Gas turbines more, combined cycle power plants less so because they have a steam component. On the distribution side, of course, you have battery storage, and I believe, and you called me in a couple of years, tell me that I was wrong, but I think the grid storage battery problem is basically now a moderate economic step away from resolution a few years. So there's that. You have demand response, which should be a very big part of the portfolio. On the distribution side of the grid, as soon as we have a significant number of electric cars, I don't mean 50%, I mean 10%. The storage problems will be really not very significant. We also, once we have appliances that are smart appliances, smart refrigerators, smart water heaters, so on, I think those are the kinds of flexible resources that are very, very good complements for solar and wind, for variable resources, because the wind doesn't blow all the time. Sun doesn't shine all the time.
Dr. Makajani, a follow-up on that. I don't want to ask it right now because we have some other people and have testified, but I wonder if you could. I would like to hear more about your comment about when we have 10% electric cars, you think that the battery storage. I'd like to hear more about that. And we meant to have your PowerPoint thing in the packets. We do not. We will get that to members. And for all the people who have spoken prior and yet to speak, if they have things they would like, that should have been included with the packets, please send them to us. We will distribute them.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just say one thing for a few seconds. The reason I said 10% is the total horsepower installed in cars, if I'm remembering the number right from a few years ago, is about 20 times the total horsepower of the electricity system. So you don't need a lot of cars to provide to feed back into the grid and to absorb surplus from the grid in order to serve as an adequate storage for variable sources. That's why I said 10% off of the top of my head, because it's a safe number. Probably you need less.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And John Hottinger said he will provide written testimony instead, I believe. Mm-hmm. So you'll provide that instead of speaking. So Bill Grant. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members, Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. and appreciate this opportunity to provide testimony on Senate File 306. And I think these same comments would apply to Senate File 536. And the department is opposed to both of these measures. There are many strong reasons to keep Minnesota's nuclear moratorium in place. And really, there are three main issues that I want to cover. First, nuclear power plants remain an unacceptable energy source until our nation finds solutions to nuclear waste disposal, safety issues, and the high cost of development that would be paid by ratepayers. Instead, we should continue to demand a national solution to the nuclear waste dilemmas that face us here, both Prairie Island and Monticello. Otherwise, these two communities in Minnesota may become permanent repositories for nuclear waste. Second area is the argument around the need for baseload power. Based on current projections, Minnesota does not need new nuclear power plants, even though they provide steady baseload power. According to utility plans submitted to our Public Utilities Commission, Minnesota does not need to build baseload power for at least the next 15 years. The last nuclear power plant in Minnesota began operating in 1973. The last coal-fired power plant, the other form of baseload power that's frequently mentioned, was commissioned in 1987. In the meantime, Minnesota Electric Utilities have responded to increasing electricity demand with a diversified mix of lower cost and environmentally preferable resources, such as wind power and facilities that burn natural gas and biomass fuel. Increasingly, utilities and their customers are taking advantage of the steep drop in the cost of solar, adding further diversity to our energy mix. Minnesota has also invested in energy efficiency and conservation that has eliminated the need for more than two large baseload coal and nuclear power plants during the time that we've been making those investments. These investments keep energy dollars working in the state to produce jobs and lower energy costs for both residential and business consumers. Minnesota is well positioned to utilize lower cost natural gas, new hydroelectricity under development in Canada, in addition to expected contributions from renewable energy and energy efficiency resulting from the legislature's far-sighted policies of the last few years. And then the third area is cost. Costs to build and operate a nuclear power plant in Minnesota are excessively high and uncertain. Lessons learned from the 2011 nuclear plant disaster in Japan have driven the cost of building and operating a nuclear plant ever higher. The couple of nuclear plants that were mentioned earlier, currently on the drawing board or under construction, will rely not only on ratepayers but on construction cost guarantees underwritten by taxpayers. Accordingly, even under optimistic estimates, nuclear power would be more expensive than several other energy sources, including energy efficiency, wind power, and natural gas-fired turbines. Consumer rate impacts, particularly to struggling businesses facing global competition, and low-income Minnesotans already paying a disproportionate share of their income for energy, would be unacceptably severe. In Minnesota, we have about 180 electric utilities. These utilities deliver reliable, low-cost electricity. The economic and environmental performance of our electric utilities is better today now due to strategic investments in cleaner, more efficient technologies. Other energy sources have significant advantages over nuclear power. They offer a lower risk of delays and cost overruns. They can be implemented on a smaller scale with a shorter development schedule. And they do not escalate the legacy problem of radioactive waste. In short, a new nuclear power plant in Minnesota would be uneconomical and a drain on our economy. I know there are some who favor repeal of the nuclear moratorium because this might lead to future construction jobs on a nuclear power project. But even if a Minnesota utility starts planning a nuclear power project tomorrow, the first construction worker would not be hired until 2025 or later. In conclusion, the Department of Commerce is committed to working on Minnesota's energy future with the legislature, Minnesota's electric utilities, and stakeholders to determine how we can best meet our statewide energy needs and strengthen our economy without exposing ourselves to the higher costs and risks of nuclear power. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. Questions from the committee. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Grant, do you have any information of what 111D will do to the nuclear industry?
Mr. Grant. Mr. Chairman and Senator Rosen, I don't have any specific information about that. It clearly creates a problem for us in the 2030s, as was mentioned earlier, if both of those facilities close and we have to replace that non-carbon energy source. That's why beginning to plan now for that eventuality makes a lot of sense. But what the specific impacts will be very hard to determine without knowing whether and on what schedule those plants would, in fact, retire.
Senator Rosen.
Sure. Thank you. Mr. Grant, you made a comment that I just need a little more clarification that expanding nuclear would be a drain on our economy. Because we had nuclear, I think we've been able to actually have the economic growth in the state, because we've had low rates and they've been sustainable and they're economical. So by expanding nuclear, can you explain why that comment drain on our economy? I don't understand that.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rosen, we had the good fortune to build nuclear at the time when nuclear costs were relatively competitive with other forms of energy sources. That's simply no longer the case. Most estimates of nuclear power costs are that it's several times more expensive than the next leading competitor, and those are the costs that we're thinking would not be a help to our economy, but rather a drain.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But, Mr. Grant, do we truly have a handle on the cost of our renewables? And that is the question that apparently we are dealing with the 40% on Thursday. Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
We're taking that bill up one of these days, yeah.
Okay. That's true. Those are the questions that we will need to get to, is what is the true cost of renewables? So I would argue that, you know, we could probably have a wash on this.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I look forward to that conversation.
Okay.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, I am just really glad that the marker has been put down that cost should be a huge consideration in what goes into our energy portfolio. I think historically it has been environmental concerns and whatever's popular at the time. So it's refreshing to hear Mr. Grant concerned about cost to businesses in our energy portfolio, because I think most businesses would find it quite costly to be dependent on wind and have the wind not blow when they were in the middle of production, or they would find it quite costly to be dependent upon solar and when they're trying to run third shift manufacturing, not be able to turn on their machines. And so I'm grateful that he brought the cost discussion to the table today.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Department of Commerce has always had a strong focus on cost to ratepayers from our energy sources. Fact is that adding solar and wind power to our system is not as if the customers relying on those sources are relying on those sources exclusively. They are relying on a system that supplies energy to them across a wide variety of resources, increasingly including renewable sources, which we've demonstrated we've been able to add without reliability or excessive cost concerns.
And Mr. Chair, since Mr. Grant responded, I'd like the opportunity to respond, if I may.
Yes, briefly, and I don't want to have the debate here because you two will be able to have access to
Absolutely.
Each other in future committees, including very soon, and I do want to have the other two, but please go ahead.
And Mr. Grant, if nuclear isn't part of our portfolio, at least beginning the conversation now, we have no opportunity to have it in 15 years when it appears we're going to have power plants going offline, and that will create quite a hole in Minnesota's production. If we're anti-coal and anti-nuclear, that leaves us with gas and renewables. Hydro is not well-liked because it competes with wind and solar, and those advocates are very strong in their positions at this legislature. And so if you're not willing to talk about nuclear and you're not willing to talk about coal, you have really limited our options 15 years from now.
And Mr. Grant, you can respond to that at some later date, I hope, instead of right now, if we can. We have two more witnesses we wanted to have from the proponents briefly, and then we have, I want to get back to the questions from XL as well. So Mr. Mueller and Mr. Crocker. Mr. Mueller, not here. Mr. Crocker, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is George Crocker. I'm the Executive Director of the North American Water Office, which is the organization that was on the point when we went through an extensive series of nuclear contentions beginning back in 1988 and culminating, of course, in the legislative struggle we had in 1994. I was there throughout, on the point, learned a lot, haven't lost a debate about it since or during, and I'm here to say that the reason that nuclear is not on the table as an option is because of lessons learned during that time. The analogy I would like you to think about is using a chainsaw at the dinner table to cut your butter, okay? You can do it, but it's really, really expensive, it's really, really messy, and it has a great potential for a whole lot of collateral damage. That's why nuclear was put off the table as a result of all of the work that was done administratively as well as legislatively and through the courts in that 97 to 94 time frame. Now, it was said here that nuclear is emission free. People who say that simply don't know anything about reactor fuel. It turns out that the uranium in the reactors is U-235, which is slightly smaller than the dominant U-238, and the way that we separate it is we boil it. We boil the uranium. We boil them over coal fires. Coal fires. So maybe there's not carbon dioxide emissions at the reactor site, but that does not mean that commercial reactor operations are emissions-free. Further, after you've boiled that coal, that you earth uranium ore long enough to use, get it boiled so that you get the smaller U-235s into the centrifuges that they're arguing about now with Iran, then you got to cool it. And so far as I know, we're still cooling it in this country with CFCs, which are powerful, powerful, powerful global warming gases as well as ozone depleters. So just because it's carbon emission free at the site doesn't mean that it's emission free. The third thing I'd like to talk about a little bit is this concept of baseload. 15 years from now, baseload will be an utterly obsolete concept. It's already becoming obsolete. And the reason is that the concepts of baseload, intermediate load, peak load are central station constructs. We have central station constructs because economies of scale from the 40s and 50s and through the 70s had each unit of production becoming cheaper as we made our central station machines bigger. So we biggered them. And we biggered them and we biggered them because that meant each unit of capacity was cheaper. We've hit the wall with those economies of scale, and the modern technologies have entirely different economies driving them, where it's not the biggerness of it, but it's the number of them. They're all mass-produced on assembly lines in factories or in batches, which means that each unit of production becomes cheaper as you make more of them, which means they want to spread out, they want to be dispersed and distributed. And as we add storage to that, each one of those units will be discreetly able to be dispatched on demand according to when the intelligent consumption devices say that they're needed within microcircuits that will become increasingly dominant. So 15 years from now, you don't have to worry about coal or nukes. The modern technologies are moving very rapidly. The cost effectiveness on that economies of scale that favors mass production rather than custom-built centralization will take care of that. The final point I'd like to make has to do with what, in my view, is the ultimate of ironies, where we have Republicans and a Republican Party that is over and over and over again on record of the overreach of government, how wasteful government is, how big government is in the way, and it's time to get big government out of the way so that the people can do what they need to do. There is no industry in the history of humanity that has more of a need for big government than nuclear power, and that doesn't matter if you're talking about regulating the safety of it or providing the financing that it requires because it can't compete in the marketplace. So I would urge my Republican friends to, if they're really sincere about too much government, the last thing they should be supporting is commercial nuclear industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crocker. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Crocker, I'm glad you brought up the concept and the argument of getting uranium to the point to where it's really not, in your argument, a clean source, if I interpreted what you said correctly. I would make that same argument for wind and solar. Wind turbines and solar panels between the two require copper and nickel and silica being mined. Is that a clean process, the mining of copper and nickel?
I would totally agree that there are inputs with all of the supply side technologies that we use. But my point is that it's been claimed over and over that nuclear commercial reactors are emissions free. They aren't. There's somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 15% of the amount of carbon dioxide that's emitted in the course of fabricating the fuel as a similar production of electricity from a coal plant. So they're not carbon free.
Okay, and Mr. Chair and Mr. Crocker, my argument is, over and over and over again, we call wind and solar clean energy. But when we need to manufacture wind turbines and solar panels that require natural resources like nickel, which we import from countries that are major world polluters, and copper, that some comes from the U.S., we import some, then by your line of reasoning, these really are not clean energy sources when we go back to looking at the natural resources required to generate that electricity. So I'm using your line of logic to say over and over and over we claim these are clean energy sources when using that line of logic they are not clean energy sources.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, you are correct, sir.
Thank you.
That there are inputs. When you're making steel, when you're making any of the components, it requires inputs, obviously. The inputs that it takes to do a wind turbine are in the neighborhood of 2 or 3% of the, if you take the energy that is produced by that wind turbine and the amount of coal that it would take to produce that same amount of power, you'd have less than 3% of the coal. For a wind turbine, for example, whereas I'm saying it's over 10 to 15% for reactors. So we're still almost an order of magnitude difference, would be my point.
Very briefly, Senator Rosen, and then we want to get to Xcel's technical person.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that. And Mr. Crocker, we go back a long way, but and it's I guess it's just kind of unfortunate you turned it into a political speech here, because there's been many Democrats that have supported the nuclear industry going forward. I do believe, Mr. Chair, that this discussion actually belongs in the PUC, and that's where the discussion really should be at. So that's all I was going to say.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman, Senator, my only point is that it's the Democrats who are usually accused of ramping up big government and wanting more big government, and it's usually the Republicans that say, too much government, we need less government. And my point is that if you're supporting nuclear power, why, there is no such thing as too much government. It needs more and more and more government because it's its nature.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Crocker. I think we've got the arguments on that, both sides of that. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. both the authors can come forward. And Mr. Pickens, is it from Excel? I think there are a number of people who wanted to ask questions for that. I saw Senator Eaton and Senator Osmick earlier, and Senator Schmidt as well.
And Senator Eaton, Mr. Chair?
Yes. Yes, Senator Eaton was the one I called first because I think she was the one who started last time. Senator Eaton, Osmick, Schmidt.
Thank you. I was wondering what kind of testing has been done on nuclear plants for natural disasters like tornadoes, earthquakes,
whatever. Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name's Terry Pickens. I'm the Director of Nuclear Regulatory Policy for Xcel. In June, by way of background, I will hit my 39th year working in the nuclear power industry. 25 years of those were working as a mechanical engineer. And the last 14 years I've been spending in the policy arena, specifically working on trying to solve the nuclear waste problem at a federal level. In response to your question concerning studies, when we design our nuclear power plants, going all the way back to the 60s when we designed Monticello, were we required to design seismic, flooding, and tornado equipment qualifications into the plant. So we are designed for earthquakes, floods, and tornadoes at our site. Post-Fukushima, one of the things that the NRC has asked us to do, in light of the fact that the last time we looked at that was in the 60s, is to look at the current state of the art, reassess that, and ensure that, in fact, we have the proper protection in place to respond to earthquakes, tornadoes, and floods. So we are qualified for that.
Thank you.
Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As briefly as I can, go through these quickly. So as to Fukushima, just enlighten me on that particular episode. That was a tidal wave that brought down actually a loss of power within the plant, and that's what actually resulted in the majority of the damage. Is that correct?
It was a tsunami that overwhelmed the site, came in much higher than they expected the flooding to occur from that wave coming in. And it took out much of the safety equipment they thought they had designed there.
Okay, thank you. Additional questions. So your plants that we're currently working on right now, Monticello and Prairie Island, those are basically my age, approaching age 50, if not beyond, correct?
Monticello started in 1970, so it's been operating for 45 years, Prairie Island for 42 and 41 years.
So, Mr. Chair, is it fair to say that the safety equipment or electrical or everything in the design of those plants, being 45 years old, could be significantly improved under a new power plant and could actually be a much more efficient design as opposed to the current designs? Is that a fair statement?
I would offer two comments on that. First, our plant designs have not remained stagnant as we've operated them for 40 years. We have continuously improved our plant designs as we've gone through time. And most recently, in response to the Fukushima event, we have added significant additional equipment. That being said, you are correct that the new designs that are being looked at, the AP1000s being built down in Georgia and South Carolina, the small modular reactors, all have incorporated the lessons learned and have probably an order of magnitude greater safety than the current safe designs that we operate today.
Mr. Chair, one final question. I did tour Monticello and I saw the cask, the dry cask storage. I asked the question, and I just want to ask you this one. When you're testing the design of those storage facilities that are very long-term storage facilities and there's no moving parts, you put it in and it stays there, is it not true that you actually test it by flying things into the buildings or testing it to make sure that those casks are in such a safe state that it would basically take even a plane flying into it wouldn't do any kind of real serious damage to those storage facilities?
The dry storage systems that we use at the plant, similar to the plant, are built for earthquakes, tornadoes, and floods. The NRC does safeguarded work at the national labs where they assess the current threats from terrorism and ensure that our designs would resist those terrorist actions and stay intact. So that work is done by the NRC at a safeguarded level. We don't do that work. It's through the NRC that's done.
Thank you. Senator Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions for Mr. Pickens and Mr. Evans. First of all, just a little bit of a background on, I guess, the current regulatory environment at the federal level and any barriers to new facilities or licensures. It was referenced that a lot has changed in the last 40 years. And I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit more to that environment at the federal level. And then also if you could speak a little bit to the time horizon for making decisions relative to new investments in Minnesota. I know these are big questions, but I think these are central to this discussion. And I know that we don't have a lot of time, but if you could just speak to them.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the NRC, after the 104-some operating plants that we've had operating in this country, looked at the regulatory process. They did come up with a streamlined process. It used to be two complete different sets of public hearings for constructing and then operating. They've streamlined that process. They've incorporated design certification into that, so designs are certified by the NRC before we have to select them, in the hope that since the design is established and ready to go, that that will shorten and reduce the amount of challenges and changes as you're trying to construct it. That all leads to watching what's going on down in Georgia and South Carolina and seeing how that process works, making sure that that improved process is resulting first in safe facilities that will be brought online, but second, that it's allowed the public the interaction and that what comes out of that, it doesn't allow multiple attempts, doesn't result in extended licensing proceedings and those types of things. With all of that being said, and kind of the look-see that I've done over the years, there's state processes that we have to undergo through a certificate of need. Even if this legislation was enacted, it would take time to get through those state processes. It will take dollars to site. We have siting processes we have to do with the NRC, licensing processes. All told, those all put together with construction probably yield that you need a 10 to 12 year time horizon if you are interested in a new nuclear power plant from moving on to those processes and through those before you're going to bring it online.
Mr. Pickens, I see from former Senator Hottinger's testimony a thing that I think came from a recent Excel estimate on the cost of decommissioning 36 years after shutdown, about $1.1 billion for Monticello, and going up to 200 years after shutdown, $4.1 billion. I assume that means by when they would be removing the storage from the plant. And NRC, I would just wonder, NRC recently is saying that they expect, as I think Dr. Makajani was saying, that they may be keeping them on, that they're saying they'd be willing to have them stay on site in perpetuity or whatever. Are these numbers, are they from an Excel document recently? I know you don't have them in front of you, but it was like estimate for 36, 60, 100, and 200 years after decommissioning, after shutdown. Is that the cost of keeping them on site for that 36 years or 200 years, depending on what the scenario is? And if so, what happens if they're there permanently?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I am familiar with our triennial decommissioning filing that we recently made to the Public Utility Commission. We do it every 3 years. By Minnesota statute, we have to provide them a cost estimate for storing spent fuel on site in each of those scenarios for 60, 100, and 200 years. So we have presented 60, 100, 200, and a 36-year scenario. The 36-year scenario that we put forward was based on the most recent strategy put out by the Department of Energy in response to the Blue Ribbon Commission, where they said they believe it's feasible to have consolidated interim storage operating by the 2026 time frame and a deep geologic repository by 2048. If they were able to meet those goals, that would be a 36-year scenario. The Public Utility Commission 3 years ago told us to go with the 60-year scenario. So we are, in fact, putting enough money away to radiologically decommission the plant in the ISFACI and to manage the storage of the spent fuel until DOE removes it for 60 years after plant shutdown. We've also provided cost estimates for the 100 and 200 years with the PUC ordered assumption that we would have to replace the cask every 50 years in those longer scenarios.
And do you do any estimates on the longer than 200 years? I mean, was that surprising that NRC suggested people might be keeping them on site very long term?
My comment on that, when I heard that discussion, the generic environmental impact statement that the NRC just put in place for its continued storage rule had, in fact, three scenarios. One was the indefinite. They were ordered to do that by the U.S. Court of Appeals in order to meet NEPA requirements, but it also had a short-term, what they termed a short-term and a long-term scenario. The short-term, I believe, I'm going on memory, was 60 years. I think the long-term was 100, and then they had the indefinite. I think in the statement of considerations for the continued storage rule, although the NRC finally decided that they don't need to, by rulemaking, make an official prediction when they believe the federal government will meet its needs, in the statement of considerations, they said that they thought the short-term scenario was the most likely scenario. So even though there is a short-term, long-term, and indefinite, they weren't saying that they thought the indefinite was the way it was going to go.
I understand that. I'm just trying to find out what how it fits in. So, and then one, I had one other final question, then I think there may be questions for the authors as well. But just real quickly, in terms of the who finances a new plant, I mean, I think one of the points that was made in Dr. Makajani's thing is that financing industry isn't willing to do it, and it comes off of ratepayers would be the proposal. Is that the way Xcel would expect to finance it, or you're not talking about this yet, I assume? So
we have not discussed how we would go about financing. I can tell you that in Georgia, in South Carolina, and down in Florida, where they were looking at it, there was a lot of concern that with a 10 to 12 year window to bring these things online and billions of dollars at risk for the utilities, that they wanted to find some way to begin recovering those dollars, not wait 12 years, because that significantly increases the overall cost to the ratepayers. Now, there's been discussion of a loan guarantee program through the Department of Energy. To my knowledge, both Georgia and South Carolina, the utilities down there, have been working on trying to come to terms on the loan guarantee, but they have not, which means that right now the utilities, Georgia Power and SCANA, are working at their risk with their ratepayer and, you know, getting money from Wall Street and all of that. So at this point in time, I don't know that they're getting money from the government. They have not gotten a check from the Department of Energy through the loan guarantee program. So I think that it's typical of the way that
it's ratepayers
utilities finance.
Okay. Questions for the authors or for Mr. Pickens? Any other comments from either of the authors then? Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you for the vigorous discussion, and appreciate it very much. I think that as the years pass, updated information is very important. The big thing to realize here is that 2032 is not far away when we're talking about a huge amount of baseload power. So putting this off to not even be able to look at it, to consider it, to me is a short-sighted approach, and we have the duty to be responsible to our fellow Minnesotans, and all options should be able to be looked at. Again, lifting the moratorium just lifts the moratorium to look at it. It doesn't mean that they're going to be approved and do some of those things, but in fairness to the people of Minnesota, when you need a lead time of about 15 years, this being 2015, I think it is time to lift this moratorium and enable us to have that discussion. There are plenty of other agencies and entities and hurdles, you might say, that are still there for us to do, but we at least need to stop keeping us from having that process and that discussion. So, members, I hope that you will support this, and that, Mr. Chairman, that this will be included in your omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for allowing us to bring this forward and to at least discuss and have the both sides be back and forth in their viewpoints. I was interested, as I was looking at this information, that back at President Barack Obama's second inaugural address, he called for action to respond to the threat of climate change. And he said, leaving aside the question of whether the threat of man-made global warming is real, his call for reducing carbon dioxide emissions was calling for the state of Virginia, which is a major deposit for uranium, to lift its moratorium there from being able to go ahead and mine uranium. And uranium is a major part of the nuclear power situation. And so to see the president calling for this to happen in some small way, some small part, it just seems to me, as Senator Kiffmeyer mentioned, that as we approach 2030, 2031, 32, that we should at least be able to discuss this, to talk about it, and get back and forth the discussion about it. And I think it's very appropriate, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you both for coming and presenting. We're going to recess the committee, not adjourn it, until 4 o'clock in room 112. And we're going to just do the, there were the three bills that were very interrelated on water that we didn't get to on Thursday, and the flame retardant bill that we heard testimony on but did not take any action on. And with that, we will recess until 4 o'clock.